Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
Up to the age of 11, I wanted to be a priest, right? And then I got to senior school. I went to a comprehensive hall. Oh, no, sod that. I don't want to be a priest anymore. There's girls and stuff. What's that all about? So dismissed the priesthood completely. I bought a job lot of postcards, right? And I'd filled it all in for them. All they had to do was stick a stamp on it and vote for me. And of course I won.
Oh my God, you almost rigged the vote, Joe.
Oh, completely rigged the vote, yeah. Unbeknownst to me, the glue pot in my bag has completely spilled out with the bag open, but I didn't know this. And I sat in my dressing room for 5 hours, glue sniffing, right? I didn't know I was doing it, right? To say I was high, if someone came with a match, it would have gone up like Oppenheimer if they'd come in, right? I kid you not, I sat there for 5 hours, I was off my tits.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a comedian, actor and author who began his career as a runner-up on a TV talent show, New Faces, only to go on 17 years later to win arguably Britain's biggest popularity contest when he left the jungle as the king of the jungle in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Now 62, he's a father of 5 grown-ups, a panto veteran, a mature student, and a gym-loving marathon runner. He's about to mark his 40 years in the business with a new tour. It's called The New Normal, 40 Years of CAC. Mm-hmm. Born and raised in Essex, he worked as a welder, a builder, and also at Smithfield's meat markets, where he'd lug animal carcasses around all in the name of a day's work, before finding work on a holiday camp running the entertainments there. That led to him entering the BGT of its day, New Faces, a TV talent show, which he didn't win, but he made enough of a mark to start him out on a path to a career in comedy. In 2004, he won The Jungle and has appeared on stage in The Producers, in Monty Python's Spamalot, as well as doing voiceovers for films like Horton Hears a Who and Garfield 2. So let's dial him in, shall we? It's Joe Pasquale. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Do you want me to tell you what's been going on the weekend? When you say, how are you? Yeah. It's a long story. Shall I tell you? I'm okay.
I want it all, Joe. Don't spare the detail.
Okay, I nearly died the weekend. I nearly killed myself. I don't just meet all people, I nearly killed myself. I nearly died. I really did.
What?
I was that close. That close, right? Because I started the tour on Friday. I was in Epsom on Friday, and then from Epsom to Skegness. I don't know if you've ever been to Skegness, the land of the midnight sausage. You ever been there?
No.
You get celluloids at all time of night. It's amazing, right? Anyway, in the act, I have a great big pair of moose antlers like that, right? Great big, and they're huge things, right? And I'm going to tell you an interesting fact about that sort in a little while, about deers and what have you. But anyway, huge antlers like that, and they've got like these big prongs sticking up. And the gag is, I just put them on my head and go, I'll put too much moose on me here. That's the gag, right? Which is fair enough. And everybody laughs at it. But at the end of the act, the curtains came down and all my props are sprued all over the stage, right? And they bring the lights down, obviously, after the show. And I'm starting to put all my props away. And I literally trip over my moose head. Right, and it was in slow motion. My moose head's on the floor, like all sticking up, right? And I was just like, I'm starting to go down on, and I'm like that, I'm falling on the moose head. Now, these are like this. I was going to impale myself on 8 moose points, like this, right? Right in my belly. I was going to die. I know I'm 62, but I am quite nimble for a bloke of my age, right? So I had one leg on the ground, the other one's hanging out there, to the right hand side somewhere, right? And I managed to push myself over, my torso went over the top of the moose heads. And as I also went, it was like Tom Cruise in the new Mission Impossible film, right? I actually twisted round onto my back as well, all in a split second. It was all in slow motion. And as I came down on the moose head, right, on his prongs, it only got me in the back of the leg, right? So I was like, oh, it really hurt, but I thought, that's okay. Anyway, I went to see my tour manager who was doing the sound for me. I went, Lee, I think I've hurt my leg. Will you have a look at it? So he went, yeah, well, what have you done? I said, I've just fell over and landed on my moose head. And he really laughed. And I pulled my trousers down to show him, and he nearly fainted. He went, oh, my God, you need a medic. So I went, well, what's the matter? Because, you know, it's like when you hurt yourself, it don't really hurt. It hurts a little bit. And so he went, you need a medic.
Were you in shock?
Anyway, I must have been. So then his medic comes round the back and he goes, what have you done? So I hurt myself on my moose head. He went, what do you mean? So I don't know what I've done. Have a look. So I put my trousers down again. And he went, oh, my God, you need to go to hospital. So I went, why? He said, I can't do that. He said, you're gonna have to get it sewn up. So I said, what is it? He said, well, it's a great big hole in your leg. So I went, what do you mean a great big hole? He said, honestly, it's a big hole in your leg. So I said, how big? He went, too big for me. So anyway, he said, you've got to go to A&E. Now, this is in Skegness at 11 o'clock at night. I said, there's no way I'm going to A&E at Skegness 11 o'clock. I'll be there for 48 hours. It'll be full of every bottled, drunk person in the world there. So he said, where have you got to go to? I said, I'm going to Grimsby tonight. He said, go to Grimsby A&E. I said, Grimsby is even worse than Skegness. I'll be there for 3 weeks. So he said, well, you've got to go. So anyway, I didn't, but he patched it up. In the morning, I was in Bridlington. So I went to an A&E in Bridlington that is only open 8 hours a day. I thought that would be handy. So I'd go there 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was no one there. It was amazing. Anyway, they sewed me up, and that was it. That's the end of the story, basically. But I had to have 7 stitches. I've got a great big hole like that in the back of my leg. I actually impaled my leg. But if I'd gone straight down on my belly, I'd be
you
dead.
You almost
there.
Impaled yourself
on
a moose head.
On a dead moose head, as that.
Like some sort of martial artist.
Yeah, it would have. Yeah, but I'd been a dead martial artist. And did you know? This is true, right? Apparently, deers. You know when deers lose their antlers every summer at the end in the autumn, right? They grow them in the spring and then they fall off, don't they? You know about this, don't you?
Yeah.
Right. Well, why is you never see all these antlers on the floor then, right? And I found out. Did you know what they do? They eat them straight away.
They eat their own. Antlers.
They eat their own antlers, and that's where they get the calcium back from to grow them again the next year. Did you know that?
It's like eating their own toenails.
Don't tell me you've not done that.
No, I've not.
We haven't even started the interview
yet. They eat their own antlers.
Yeah. Look at where we are. We've not even had a glass of wine yet.
Do you know, I only had Chris Packham on 2 weeks ago, and he didn't give me nuggets like that.
No, well, see, Chris is just a chancer, you see. I know what I'm talking about.
How are you, though, Joe? Like, how's the hole? How's your
hole? Yeah, it's good. It's a bit sore. It's right in the back of my leg, just below my knee. So it's difficult to sit down anywhere. You're in that position. Wherever you sit, you're going to be on it. So it's okay, though. Yeah, it's fine, thank you. But apart from that, I'm very, very good.
And you're only just starting out on this tour, Joe.
I know, yeah.
You might have to rethink some of your props.
Yeah, I know. I've got to put some corks on the top of my moose head.
Can you qualify what CAC means, please? I'm dying to know.
Yeah, CAC. Well, it's a childish name for poo, really. I actually got heckled once in Wales. It was more than a heckle. I was in Bargoed in Gwent, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this cack, but he didn't say cack, and he threw his crutches at me.
You can
and
say
fell
shit
over.
On this show, it's okay.
Oh, can you? Yeah, he said, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that? That's a heckle, that is.
That's a mic drop.
It is, isn't it? It really is, isn't it? Yeah.
He elevated your joke and he elevated his own heckle and he actually stole the moment.
He did, completely. Well, actually got his crutches and run off. I didn't. If they're throwing things like that, I don't stay out there if I can help it. We haven't had a glass of wine. Look where we are.
So 40 years of cack. Is this like you looking back on your 40 years in the business? Because the blurb on the website tickled me, Joe. It says that you can expect things like this. You asking, if a nudist spilt beetroot soup in his lap, would he have a stain on his character? And yeah, why don't chicken breasts have nipples? Which is such a good question.
It really is. Why don't they? I don't understand it. Anyway, yeah, it's 2 hours of that, really. And I've got, because I've been doing it for so long, I've got a garage full of props, which I buy off the internet, boot sales. Well, anybody's throwing it out, I'll find a use for that. And I put it in the act. So all I've done is put a load of stuff in the back of the car and put it on the road for a few weeks. And I'm loving it because I was during that COVID, you know, those COVID years, I want to call it that, for 2 years, I live on my own. So because I wasn't working as such, really, a couple of bits of telly, but there was no live work for me anywhere, not for anyone in the business, as you know. I was just a bloke in his pants walking about the house. And I thought, well, who am I? What? That's what defines me. If I can't go out and nearly kill myself on a Saturday night at Skegness, what is my job on this world, right? And after 2 years, Lee Mead phoned me up. You know Lee Mead, right, the singer? Yeah. He phoned me up. He said, I'm doing a job at the London Palladium. He said, I'm doing a new concert. He said, but it's my first job back and I really would like somebody with me just to support me, just to do a little bit of a warm-up. Would you come and do it? And I immediately said, yes, I've not done it for 2 years either. And when I put the phone down, my bottle went complete. I thought, oh, my God, I've not done it for 2 years. What happens if I don't remember? Not that I couldn't remember what I used to do, because that changes on a nightly basis anyway. But what happens if I couldn't remember who I was that did that, that part of me that did that? Because, you know, part of my personality takes over to do that. Because, you know, at home, I'm not that bloke. But when you get on stage, that bloke takes over. And I thought, if I have to do it myself, it ain't going to work if I'm doing it. And then after the very last second, it was like my very first gig. And then when I went out there, I thought, if this is the last gig I ever do, at least it's a London Palladium. Anyway, I went out there and it was like, it just putting a coat on it. And it literally came back. It was like muscle memory. And it hadn't, because I hadn't used that part of my personality, I really didn't know if it was going to turn up. But it did. And it's quite extraordinary, really. I don't even remember what your question was now. I just go off on one, don't I?
No, it's, and do you know what, Joe? You're not the first guest to sit here and talk about kind of like the hangover of locking down on your own, because everybody had very different experiences. But I think for a lot of people that are on their own, I think only now are they starting to realise how it has impacted them, and the questions that it raised. Because, you know, just living with you and yourself, you know, nobody chooses to do that. We don't choose to isolate. Certainly not people that buzz off of working in front of an audience.
Yeah, completely. And now I'm back doing it. I was so excited on Friday night. I thought this is going to... And I was so nervous as well Friday night, because the first proper gig... I've done a few holiday games, that sort of stuff, but the first time I've done a proper tour like this in 6 years, because previously to COVID, I was on the road doing a play. I was doing Some Others Do Have Them for a few years, and that got interrupted by COVID. So after 6 years of not doing stand-up, it's quite a leap of faith again. And to say I'm loving it is an understatement. It's a really weird thing, stand-up, because I think not just stand-up, but any play, any musical, anybody goes to see, I think what people are looking for when they go for live entertainment, even a movie, is to be free of concern. For the amount of time they're putting their attention into you or to the film or to the play or the musical, their life is full of concerns. Everybody's, yours is, mine is. We all have these concerns. And if you can get people to forget about those concerns for a couple of hours, then you've done your job. And also, by the same, it's a symbiotic relationship, because I also get to forget about my concerns in that 2 hours as well. And it's a way of communicating. I don't really know what it is I'm communicating, But what it is you're all on the same level and everybody's laughing at the same thing. And I laugh at my own stupidity all the time on stage. And it's like putting a 13-year-old up there. There's nothing clever. There's no social commentary. There's no political bias. It's just a 13-year-old talking about farts, willies and bums and chicken breasts. That's all it is for 2 hours.
Denouncing their lack of nipples.
Can I say I really enjoyed talking to you? This is great.
Good. Well, I'm glad because I've put some thought behind the three questions that I've drafted for you, Joe. So let's rewind and jump in with question one, if you don't mind.
Yes.
I wanted to chart some of the phone calls or conversations that changed everything for you. And I wanted to kick off with the call that you got while you were working at the holiday camp at the very beginning of your career as a performer. It was a call from ITV asking you to come and take part in New Faces.
Yes. Well, what happened was I was calling bingo and refereeing wrestling at the holiday camp. And oh, no, it really was. And these wrestlers, right, they would come in.
Would the holiday makers wrestle, Joe?
No, that was just the professional wrestlers, right? But they weren't the ones off the telly. These, yeah.
I just thought, well, it's a bit rough, isn't it?
Yeah, it says goddamn early.
I mean, I've been to some places, but never seen that.
These are the £7.50 ones in the sun, that's what it is. So what happened was, right, these wrestlers would come down and they'd do like 40 camps over the week. So they'd do like 4 or 5 camps a day, these wrestlers, right? And they'd get to us on a Thursday or a Friday. Bear in mind, they've been on the road since Sunday, doing 4 or 5 shows a day. And they'd put up the ring, do 3 bouts, put the ring down and go to another camp down the road. And by the time they got to us, they've still got the same leotards on that they've had all week, right? And to say they were minging would be an understatement. I was gipping all the time. And they'd put me in headlocks. I was refereeing. They'd put me in their headlocks and they'd stick me in my head between their legs in their gusset. And it was, honestly, I was gipping every day. I couldn't eat before it because I'd just be throwing up. And all the old ladies would absolutely love it, but I hated it. I hated the wrestling. Anyway,
Don't we? Wrestling was a big thing, like Big Daddy. Big Daddy was like a massive star when we were growing up. Jeff Capes, World's Strongest Man.
Yeah, it was all that. And Tarantula, one called Tarantula as well. Great big hairy bloke. And so I would have to do that, and I'd also have to do like a swimming guard, that sort of stuff. You'd be a lifeguard, but you didn't have to be able to swim a lot because it was only 3'6". As long as you were taller than 3'6", you could be the swimming guard, and I was. So, and I remember one day we had a bloke turned up on holiday. He's only got one eye, right? And he's got a glass eye in, and so he's walking along beside the swimming pool, and it says no diving because he's only 3'6". But it was on his blind side, as it were. He didn't see it, and he dives in the water, bangs his head, pops his head up, and he's lost his glass eyes, popped out. And everybody in the swimming pool is going, oh, he's lost an eye. And they're all screaming and they're all getting out of the water like it was the film Jaws. Do you know, in that bit in the Jaws, all the sharks here. And he was all right because it was a glass one. He didn't really feel it, just banged his head a bit. And he's trying to calm down. It's all right, it's my glass eye. So they're all out, it's just him in the water. And he goes to me, Joe, can you help me find my glass eye? So I said, well, where is it? It's what's in here somewhere. I said, what colour is it? He went, the same as this one, and pointed to his real eye, which is blue, which is the same colour as the bottom of the swimming pool. So I'm in there with a one-eyed bloke looking for a glass eye the same colour as the bottom of the swimming pool. It was like a needle in a haystack. Anyway, every now and then I'd kick it with my toes. I went, I found it. Oh, I kicked it. And then I'd have to, you couldn't see it. You'd go under, couldn't see it because it's the same colour, disguised. Anyway, eventually I found it with my toes, and I wedged it in between my big toe and my long toe, and I lifted my foot out of the water. Right, and I went, is that it? And if he'd said no, right, it would have been a nightmare. He went, yeah, that's the one. So I thought it must be. Anyway, picked it out of my toes, and he sucked it for a minute and then popped it back in his eye. I thought, he's going to get verruca in a week on his eyeball. Anyway, he didn't, but that was it. So I'm going to your original question. So these are the jobs I was doing, and then a load of people bet me that, why don't you go for an audition for New Faces? I said, yeah, but I don't do anything. I just find glass eyes and call bingo and referee the wrestling. And my head stuck between somebody's gusset. What am I going to do? And they went, oh, you'll find something. Anyway, I went to the audition. I only had one joke. And the joke was I had a tiny little guitar out of a great big guitar case. And there was 3 people there. Richard Holloway. You know Richard Holloway, right?
I do know Richard Holloway.
Yeah, I knew you'd know. Richard was the producer on it, right? And he's sitting in front of me.
Yeah, well, Richard was in charge of X Factor when I
worked
on that.
That's right, he was. I know
he was. Where's the cravat?
That's Richard, yep. A very classy bloke, look very like that, right? And there's me, Divvy Boy, in front of him saying, I've got a lovely Spanish folk song And I get my little guitar out of a big case, and they laughed a little bit. And he said, "What's the song called?" I said, "It's called A Mouche Zadou A Guy." Right? And then this bloke on the piano, he said, "Would you like any music?" So I went, "Well, if you think of anything." And he started playing all this flamenco stuff. And I stopped him, and I went, "What are you doing?" I said, "You've already got the job. I'm the one auditioning." And he said, "Well, just sing the song." And I went, "A mouche zadougi in the window." And I smashed the guitar up, right? And I walked off. And so they're really laughing at me. And I just went back to calling the bingo. I went, "Thank you." Went back to calling the bingo. And then about a week later, I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was Naomi Rose, I think her name was, who was the casting agent. The lady receptionist at the holiday camp said, "Joe, we've got a call for you." So I said, "Who is it?" So I don't know. Somebody from, ATV, I think it was at the time. Central Television it was, in Birmingham. Mm. So I said, "Okay." So I answered it and she went, "Hello, is that Joe?" So I said, "Yeah. Hi, this is Naomi Rose from ITV. So we need to speak to your manager." So I said, "Oh, he's very busy at the moment." So I said, "Oh, okay, well, what's he doing?" She said, "Well, he's looking after everybody." So I said, "What do you mean? What's his name?" So I said, "Mr. Lee." So I said, "Well, who does he look after?" "So he looks after everybody." So she went, "What do you mean, everybody?" "Well, everybody here." She said, "Well, who's everybody here?" "So there's about 380 people here." She went, "Well, who does he manage?" "Well, he manages them all. I don't understand what you're asking me." So she, "Well, what acts does he manage? No, he's not. He doesn't manage acts. He manages the kitchen. He manages the bars. He manages the swimming pools. He manages. He does the whisk drive. He does everything." So I'm slightly confused who he is. So his name's Mr. Lee. So I said, "Well, Mr. Lee who?" So I said, "No, it's not his first name. His name is Mr. Lee." So what's his first? And I didn't really. I said, "What's Mr. Lee's first name?" And they went, "Francis." "Well, his name's Francis Lee." And they went, "What, the footballer?" So I said, "No, he's not a footballer," because apparently there was a footballer called Francis Lee. I went, "He's a manager, general manager of the holiday camp." And they went, "Holiday camp? What holiday camp?" And I said, "Well, it's Warners." "Whereabouts is it?" So I did lower stuff, and this went on for ages, and it was like a sitcom. And in the end, they went, "Well, basically, we don't understand what you're talking about here. We'd like to offer you the show." So I said, "What show's that?" And I'd forgotten about it. And they went, "Well, New Faces." So I said, "Well, I haven't got an act." And they went, "Doesn't matter. Just do what you did." And that was like nearly 40 years ago now. And I busked it on the night. I won the heat. And then I come second in the final. But what I did when I was at the holiday camp, right, because it was pre-recorded. And in those days, it wasn't like get your phone and, you know, dial it in and here's your thing. It was all done by postcards.
No, it was just judges, right?
It was judges, but also it was postcards as well, right?
You had to send
the general public had to send a postcard in. That's how long ago it was, right? Send a postcard. So what I did, it was on for a bit. I'd recorded it.
Can you imagine now, Joe, somebody being bothered to do that?
Yeah, but there was only 3 channels then, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Idea of, like, you know, people sometimes, some people can't even be bothered to vote on their phone that's in their hand, let alone go buy a postcard, fill it out, buy a stamp, walk to the post box, post it. I mean, that's an investment.
Yeah, but guess what I did though? Guess what I did? This was like 4 months before it actually was being aired. So there was like 18 weeks, 16 weeks then of all these people, all these punters going on holiday. So I went down to a warehouse. I bought a job lot of postcards, right? So that at the end of the day, I gave them all out to everybody at the holiday camp and I'd filled it all in for them. All they had to do was stick a stamp on it and vote for me. That was it. I put my name on it. I put the address. All I didn't do was buy the stamps. I said, if you enjoyed your holiday week this week, if you enjoyed the wrestling, just stick that in the post for us at the end of the week. And of course, I won. I won the heat and I was straight through the final.
Oh my God, you almost rigged the vote, Joe.
Oh, completely rigged the vote. Yeah, if you couldn't, you can't rig a vote on the phone lines, but you can if you do it in the old times, you know, with postcards.
And that's how much what did you spend on those postcards, do you reckon?
Oh, I spent a good couple of £100 on them in the end, because it was hundreds and hundreds.
That's an investment in yourself, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was, totally, yeah. They didn't have a clue what I was talking about. They just thought, "Oh, he's been a nice boy. Let's send it off for him." They'd stick a stamp on it, and it went. Yeah, it was an amazing.
So if you
experience.
Think about that, right? That £200 probably changed everything for you.
It changed my life completely, yeah. And I had no idea, you know, because, and even then, you know, nearly 40 years later, I am still busking it, you know. I've been busking it all my life. And I don't take it too seriously, though, Kate. I love the business, but it's just a job. But I do like making people laugh. That's been my day job for 40 years.
But that's serious business because, you know, you talked earlier about people, you know, you've done your job when somebody can literally leave their worries at the door and lose themselves for a couple of hours. In some ways, that's a medicine, isn't it?
Oh, completely. It really is. Because it's more medicine for me more than anything else. Because I think most comics, before they become, if you want to be a comic and before you actually go professional, I think all you are is an annoying little sod. Because all you're trying to do is be funny. And everybody's going, oh, it's so annoying. But if you're down the pub at work, I was annoying. All the jobs I had beforehand, I was just annoying because I was just trying to be funny, trying to make people laugh all the time. I used to make my mum laugh as a kid growing up. And that was a joy. My real joy in my life was trying, because she was suffered from bad depression, my mum. And my joy was literally just to make her laugh. And I remember once, I was only about 15, and she'd had a bad time. And she was in a bit of a state, and I pretended. I said, look, Mum, you've got to cheer up because Eamon Andrews is coming. So she went, what are you talking about? And Eamon Andrews used to do This Is Your Life, as you probably remember.
Yeah.
Right? And I said, Eamon Andrews is coming around. She said, what for? I said, they're going to do This Is Your Life. And she went, what do you mean? So I said, look, you just put some makeup on, have a wash, because Eamon Andrews is coming round. So anyway, she went and got changed, put some makeup on, had washed her hair and came in. And she went, what's happening then? I said, they're going, This Is Your Life on you, Mum. She said, oh, don't be stupid. Anyway, I'll go and get him there. Anyway, I went out, came back in, dressed as Eamon Andrews, and I pretended to be all the family for about an hour. And it was great. It cheered her right up. But she would have had a weak, as she got older, she had a weak bladder, right? And when I got older as well, I'd go around to see her, and she would say, don't you say a word. Don't say nothing yet. I said, why not? I've got to put a newspaper under me. And she would literally wet herself at me. She'd have such a loose... There was no tenor ladies in those days, right? And before I could say anything, because I'd literally go around there just trying to make her laugh. And I would. It was a great thing that I did for me personally and for her. But she couldn't cope with it. And she everywhere was just... It smelt a wee. The house smelt a wee, though. It was bad.
I mean, that takes me actually just jump straight into my next question, because that was very much at the heart of what I wanted to talk to you about next. It's about kind of flipping the narrative, I suppose, and finding silver linings in some of the most difficult and challenging times in life. Like, for example, your mother's depression. That came as a result of a terrible car accident that she'd been in that left her with depression and epileptic fits. And you decided there and then that you were going to be a positive in her life. And that's how you ended up trying to make her laugh every day. So when else in life have you managed to find the good from a difficult or terrible situation?
Oh, this is an incredible story. I love this story. And it's very sad, but it's also, it makes me laugh and it makes me smile. My dad was a staunch Catholic. My mum was Church of England, but so she wasn't a churchgoer as such, but Dad was. And I went to a Catholic school, and I remember being five and having to go to confession at 5 years old. Now, imagine going to confess. What had I done at 5 years old? I had to confess, right? I was like, what have I done? What could I would have? And so I'd go in there, and I'd say, I threw a stone at Vincent Garvey today, right? And I hadn't really. I'd go, oh, say two Hail Marys and How's Your Father? And that'd be it, right? So then a week later, I could go back and say I'd lied last week because I'd lied in the confession. It was a very weird, complex thing that was going on with the Catholic Church in those days. And I was convinced. It's very weird.
As a five-year-old, have to go to confession? That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I went to a Catholic school, so I was taught by nuns and priests up to the age of 11. And at that point, all they do is reinforce. They want you, they want what you on the team. And up to the age of 11, I wanted to be a priest, right? And then I got to senior school. I went to a comprehensive, sod that. I don't want to be a priest anymore. There's girls and stuff. What's that all about? So dismissed the priesthood completely. Anyway, my dad still, after that, I never went to church at all. And he didn't mind. He was okay about it, but he still went. And then towards the end of his life, he became very ill. And, as most people do when they're very old and they die. But he couldn't go to church at one point, so the priest used to come to his house and still give him Holy Communion. And invariably, I'd be there on a Sunday, and I'd say, look, Dad, I can't sit here and watch this. Do you mind if I go into your bedroom and watch a bit of telly? Yeah, you go in there. And he'd have, like, a little private mass in the living room. It was really lovely of the priest to come and do that for him. Anyway, he got worse and worse, physically worse and worse, and he was ill for so many times, for about 10 years. And I remember once my sister phoned me and she went, Joe, you've got to get to the hospital. He's going to be gone by, it's about 8 a.m. They reckon he'd be no longer than about 12 o'clock, he'd be gone by lunchtime. Okay, so I'll get in the car, go straight to the hospital, and I'm there next to him. He was at death's door. I thought, oh God, he's going to go. And then I was there for a couple of hours and went, Joe, I've got to get a bit of fresh air just for a little while. Julie's my sister, right? So I said, okay. So I went out, I stayed there for about half an hour. I thought, I better go in. Then my phone went. I went, oh, God. And it was my dad's phone. And I thought, oh, no, he's gone. I've missed it. And Julie said, oh, no, my dad went, where are you? And I went, I'm outside. He went, what are you doing out there? So I said, I'm just getting a bit of fresh air. He said, well, on the way in, will you get me a sausage roll? So I said, what? He went, get me a sausage roll, will you? I said, you're supposed to be dead by 12 o'clock. And he went, no, I'm not going to be dead. I feel a bit better now. Well, the hospital said, Julie said that you're going to be dead by 12 o'clock. No, I'm starving. Get me a sandwich. They've not fed me. So, well, they've not fed you because they thought you were dying, you silly sod. And he went, well, I'm not dying. Just get me a sausage roll, will you? So I go back in, give him a sausage roll. He's got no teeth in, and he sucks on this sausage roll for an hour, right? And eventually they let him out the next day. I went, oh, bloody hell. So this went on for a few years where he was at death's door, then he's not at death's door. He gets better. He kept going up and down for years and years and years. And I said goodbye to him so many times physically and in my head that this will probably be the last time I see him. And it never was until the day it was. And what happened was, I think it was on the Friday, I got a chance to go to Venice for a weekend to work out there. So I said, Dad, I've got a chance to go to Venice this weekend. Do you mind if I go? He went, no, you go. Great, you've got a chance to go to Venice. So I said, you'll be all right. He said, yeah. And my sister was there as well. Julie was there. And he said, you go. If you've got a chance, go. He said, look. I said, you're going to be all right. He said, look, I'm not going to die before you come home. So I said, all right, as long as you're sure. I'm positive. You go. I'm not going to die before you go home. Okay. And it was Easter Sunday, right, coming up. And I don't know if you know this. Most people don't know this. But the name Pasquale means Easter. And in Italy, it's a Christian name. Yeah, my great-granddad's name was Pasquale Isernia, and when he came to England, he couldn't speak English, and he put his surname where his Christian name should be on the immigration form, so his Christian name became our surname, and it means Easter. So anyway, he said to me, I'll ask you one favour, though. So I said, what's that? He said, when you're over there, will you go to church on Sunday morning and have Holy Communion for me? So I said, well, if that's what you want, Dad, he said, yeah, I'd love it if you did that. So I went, all right, fair enough then. I will. That's what I'll do. So anyway, I was over in Venice Sunday morning. I get up and go to this lovely, beautiful, ornate church in Venice. And it's Easter Sunday, so it's packed. You know, the Catholics in Italy, and it's you know, Easter is a huge thing for Catholics, as you know. And it was absolutely rammed packed. It was like the Pope was going to be there himself. Anyway, because the name Pasquale means Easter, every couple of minutes, the sermon from the priest is all about Easter. So every 5 minutes, you go, Pasquale, Pasquale. Now, I don't speak Italian at all, but all I could hear was Pasquale. And he's like, I'm putting my hand up every time he said it, put it like this. And eventually, it got to the end of the Mass, and I've joined the queue, and there must have been hundreds and hundreds of people there queuing up for the little bit of bread, right, for the little wafer. And it was like a little bit of wafer, a little white wafer like that with a cross, sign the cross on it. And I queued up for it, and then he went and put it in, and then he did the sign of the cross, gave it to me. And I came out, and I immediately phoned my dad, and my sister answered. And she went, Julie answered. I went, hello, love, is he there? And she went, no, he's gone. I said, where's he gone? So she went, he's gone. I said, yeah, but where? She said, no, you're not listening to me, he's gone. I said, you don't mean he's dead? So he's literally just gone. I said, how long ago? I said, 5 minutes ago. And I went, oh, for Christ's sake. She went, yeah, it is for his sake, because I was having Holy Communion, and that's when he went. And I'm convinced that he decided to go while I was away. And Julie says the same thing, that, he didn't want to be there. He didn't want me to be there when it was really happening. And then I lost my passport as well while I was over there, and I was in Italy, stuck in Italy. I had to make my way to Milan to get another passport, and I was stuck in Italy for 10 days. So she did all the hard work of sorting it all out afterwards. But,
Wow. I mean, God, maybe he really was just waiting to get you into church, Joe.
Yeah, I think he was.
All those years you'd excused yourself and gone into the other room. He decided to do the proverbial the same.
Yeah, he did. And it was, so once again, it's not even said, it's just a, it was a very sad time, sad situation. Sounds like a song there, doesn't it? But it was also quite, if it's going to happen, that's the best way for it to happen, that I was doing that for him. And you know, it's just a weird situation. And it's all Easter Sunday and Pasquale and all of that, all in one.
Pasquale. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was quite a warm feeling at the same time, even though it was devastating as well.
Yeah, that really is finding the silver lining, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was another time that you were forced to dig deep to do that. That involved you glue sniffing and Ken Dodd. Do you remember?
Yeah, of course I remember that. I can't believe you. So is that the story you was expecting me to tell, not a story about my dad?
No, I just, you know, it's just one that's stuck in my mind. And when you explain what happened, the listener will understand why it's quite bizarre.
Well, this was on New Faces then. This was on that heat that I was telling you about where I got everybody to send their postcards in. As I said, I didn't have an act.
Like an important moment, Joe, yeah? Let's just set the scene here. This isn't just like any old gig. This is the gig.
This is the gig. And also in those days, right, there was only four channels. So New Faces was getting 18 million viewers. Can you believe anything getting 18 million viewers now? It did. 18 million viewers, right? Marty Kane was the host, who was lovely. She was a wonderful lady. And I put this routine together. I'll tell you what happened. You do the routine in the afternoon, and then all the judges watch it. That's what they do. And then they could decide if you're any good, whether they like you. And they write their little comments down. And then it's just a dress rehearsal in the afternoon. So it's not like Britain's Got Talent where they see it for the first time. These people actually saw it. And Ken Dodd was on my panel. And I went into makeup afterwards, and Ken said to me, "Oh, can I give you a bit of advice?" And I was like, "That, oh my God, it's Ken Dodd." I was in awe of him. Can I give you a bit of advice? Yeah. So I said, "Yeah, of course you can, Ken." And he put this bit of paper out, and he'd rewritten my whole act. He wrote down everything I said, and he said, "Right, this joke here, get rid of that joke. It's too old. No one does that. Get rid of that one there. Put that one there. Move that one to the beginning because there's a stronger one there, but you want to finish on that. When you pull the rabbit out of the hat, put it down your trousers, shake your leg, it'll come at the bottom, you get an extra laugh on that. If you do this and do all of the things I've just said to you, you'll win tonight." So I went, okay, and I did put all that into practice, and I did win the heat. But previously to that, one of the routines I was doing on it was I had a handkerchief, and I'd say, "This, ladies and gentlemen, is a magician's handkerchief." And I pull this hanky out, I say, "You can't cut it." And I have plastic scissors, and I say, "You can't saw it," and I have a little plastic saw, and "You can't rip it," and I try and tear it, and it won't burn. And I'd set fire to it, and then it would start burning, and I'd drop it on the floor, and I'd stamp it out, and my shoe would go on fire. And I'd take my shoe off, and then I'd put my sock on it, I'd put my foot on it with the sock, and then my sock would go on fire, and I'd just stand there and watch it all burn. And I just looked up at the audience and went, "That obviously is not a magician's handkerchief." That was the gag, right? Anyway, to get all this to burn, I thought, how am I going to get this to burn? Because stuff isn't flammable anymore. Did you know the word inflammable and flammable mean the same thing? If something's inflammable, it's the same as flammable. It's ridiculous. Why is inflammable and flammable the same? Anyway, so that's beside the point. So, of course, I'm thinking, how can I set fire to all this stuff? So I got some of that glue that you use on tabletops, you know, to stick the vinyl down. And it's got so many fumes coming off it, and it's very flammable as well. So I covered my shoe and my sock in this stuff to make sure that it would burn. Anyway, it worked. It worked perfectly in the rehearsal in the afternoon, right? Perfectly. And then so I've got the glue in my bag, go up to my dressing room, another 5 or 6 hours later before you do the live show. And, of course, I go up there. Unbeknownst to me, the glue pot in my bag has completely spilled out. They didn't put the top on properly. It's all over the show inside my bag with the bag open, but I didn't know this. And I sat in my dressing room. You're not allowed to leave the dressing room. Once you're in there, you're in there. And I sat in my dressing room for 5 hours glue sniffing, right? I didn't know I was doing it, right? To say I was high, if someone came with a match, it would have gone up, right? It would have gone up like Oppenheimer if they'd come in, right? I kid you not, I sat there for 5 hours. I was off my tits completely. I didn't know what I was doing, right? Didn't have a nerve in my body, not a single nerve, right? I went out and it was like I was just going down to Tesco's for me. Didn't have a nerve in my body, and that changed everything as well. And I learned then, nerves don't really help you. Just get rid of them. Get rid of the nerves. Yep.
See, you managed to find the positive in glue sniffing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really did. It was incredible, but I'd never tried it since.
We don't advocate glue sniffing. It's not big, it's not clever.
It's not good either. No, it's... No, don't do it.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You have lived a life, Joe. You really have.
I'm still living.
You ready for your third and final question?
I am indeed, lovely.
You've discovered a love of sport and education late in life. You hated sport at school and you left school before you'd even sat your exams, only to go on to become a gym-loving marathon runner in later life, sitting an Open University degree as an adult. So I wanted to know what took you so long and why sometimes it's important to go back and try something for a second time or just wait until the time is right.
Well, this is, once again, it is about the time is right. And I don't think that kids should go to school when they're kids. You should go because no one wants to, you know, unless you're an exceptional, gifted kid, you just want to play. And that's all I wanted to do was play. And you're not at your best between 5 and 15, are you, really? I know you're supposed to be best when you're growing years, but that's not when you're at your best. I know it's not. It's not when I was at my best. I was a complete div. And I broke my leg when I was 13. I got run over quite badly. Not there's a good way of getting run over, but it was a bad break on my hip. And in the early 70s, they didn't have the technology available to mend things like they do today. And I was in plaster because I broke it on my hip. I was in plaster from my ankle right the way up to my chest here. And
oh,
so,
Joe.
Oh, yeah, it was terrible, really terrible break it was.
For how long?
I was in traction for about 6 weeks, first of all, which is where they put the weights at the end of. You don't see that in hospitals anymore. They don't do that. Well, they put a pin through your leg and then they put wires on the end of it and then put weights on the end of it to pull it down. What's that all about?
You know, the only time I remember seeing that is in things like Carry On films.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's exactly it. But that's what they did to me, right? And then after they realised that wasn't going to work, so they just said, I'll stick a plaster on it. So my right leg is an inch shorter than my left leg. And I know this. There is a reason for me telling you all of this, because it does, you know, go towards the learning thing, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And then they put me in plaster. And because it was only one side of my leg, I only had one leg in plaster, right? But it went round my waist up to here. So my willy wasn't plastered at all, right? But I couldn't get any pyjamas on because my pyjamas, because they were my size. I was only 13. I was only little at that age. And so I'd just wear my dad's drawstring pyjamas. I'd cut the legs off, and so they were a bit shorter for me, but so they're wide enough to get around my waist with a big drawstring. Couldn't wear any pants because I couldn't do it, and I had to use a bedpan as well because I couldn't bend over to sit on the toilet. So I was like that for about 3 months, right? And I remember being in the hospital, and I got to use crutches. It was great, right? I learned how to use crutches. And I would say, once I got really proficient with them, it was an all-sit hospital in Essex. It was all glass. It was one of these modern hospitals, glass everywhere. And I'd go and see my mum and dad off to the end of the ward, and then I'd run back on my crutches as quick as I could to the big window in my ward and wave at them in the car park. I could see them in the car park. And, of course, the first time I'd done this, I'm going as quick as I can, really, really, really quick. I'm going back to try and get to the window before they get to their car. And I get there, And I'm waving at them. And then everybody else is leaving because it's the end of visiting time. Everybody else is going to their cars like that. And they're all looking up and everybody's like that. And I can see everybody, so a few people are laughing and pointing up at the window. And they're all doing that. And I think, what are they all pointing at, right? And then I can hear the people behind me, the other people in the beds behind me, all laughing. And I thought, what are they laughing at? And then I realised I couldn't feel it because I'd gone so fast on the crutches down the wall. The drawstring under my dad's pyjamas had loosened and I was standing at the window and my pyjama bottoms had gone to the floor. And I, bear in mind, I can't bend over to pick them up. I'm standing there, right, at the window with loads of people in the car park and my willy is out. Right, one leg is great big fat plastered, a skinny leg on the other side with a little willy, right? And one bum cheek at the back. Everybody behind me can see one bum cheek, right? And of course, they're all pointing, and I just stood there crying, right? And I didn't know what to do. And then a nurse came on and pulled my trousers up for me, and that was it. I was so embarrassed, right? And I think that embarrassment stayed with me, and I don't know why, but it gave me a sense of don't take life too seriously. That's what, and it still stays with me near that. So because of that break, I missed a year of school. And I went back to school afterwards. I'd missed that year where you do your options, you know. And I wanted to be a geologist. That's what I was going to do, geography and geology and be a scientist, all those things. Of course, I ended up doing home economics and a bit of art. And I just, what they do, just go to the art room, take some pencils and some crayons with you. And that's what I'd do for another 3 years at school. So by the end of it, I had no exams when I came out. And then after doing I'm a Celebrity, which was 20 years ago now, can you believe that was 20 years ago? I came out of that, and after doing a parachute jump, and I was scared of flying, I thought, if I can jump out of planes, I should be able to learn to fly. Don't ask me why I did that, because I was scared of flying. So when I got my pilot's license, and as a byproduct of that, I had to pass 7 exams, and I hadn't done the exams since I was 15. I failed them all. So and I passed all of them for my flying, and I thought, if I can pass exams like that, surely I could do geology, which is what I wanted to study when I was at school. So I did a courses with the Open University on geology, and I passed all of those, and it was fantastic. And as a byproduct of that, I thought, I've never done any exercise, really. I should do some exercise. I've never had a fight in my life. So I took up boxing. And as a byproduct of that, I started running. And then I thought, I've never done a marathon. So I did a marathon. And as you said, it's when the timing is right. It's when you're in the right place. In your head, really, to be able to do those things. And I realised, after Mum went out, that I realised your own mortality, we're not here forever. And I thought, if I don't do these things now, I'm never going to do them. The thing is with flying, I love flying, but nobody comes with me. Nobody will ever come with me because they won't even sit on the same settee as me. You imagine, you know, because I'm quite accident-prone. but I love flying, and same as I love exercise now. And one of the joys that I've ever...
Yeah, because you've run marathons, Joe. I mean, that's not for the faint-hearted.
And no, it's not.
When I Google you, there's pictures of you all ripped, right? All ripped online with women, like, properly fangirling over you going, oh, my God, what a dilf. You're a dilf.
Don't think I'm a div. No, I'm just a div. That's what I am. I'm not a dilf.
Seriously, Joe, I mean, you've seen it, right? You're a meme. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're a fit 50, well, 60 something now.
62.
So how old were you when you first saw an ab?
Oh, well, I suppose it was about 15 years ago I took up boxing. But what it was, I was still eating a lot of wine gums in those days. So it wasn't until I did the Real Full Monty for ITV, you know, where they, it was a great thing to do, that was. And I thought, if I'm going to go on television, because I was boxing all the time and running I was very fit. I'm still reasonably fit now, in actual fact, which is why I managed to, you know, miss the moose head the other day. But I thought, if I'm going to go on telly now and get stark naked, this was a thing for prostate cancer. I don't even remember that they used to do it every year with Ashley Banjo, would front it all, along with Alexander Armstrong. So at the end of it, you'd do this routine that Ashley would choreograph, and at the end, you'd literally strip naked so you can leave your hat on. That was the song. And it was done in front of a live audience and televised, all that. I thought, if I'm going to get my winkle out again, that hasn't been out in the public since when I was 13 at the hospital, then I want to look as cut as I can be. So I was still at the boxing gym, and I went like, put me on a proper diet, let me know what I've got to do. So I did all of the stuff. I've got to the point where I went, oh, this is pretty good. It was like Brad Pitt in Fight Club almost. That's what I wanted to achieve. So I've got to that point. And then, of course, you do the show with Ashley and you do it, and it's great. You don't see a lot in it because they use these blinders, what they call blinders, huge bright lights when you take everything off. But once the blinders have gone off, you don't see it on telly. You don't see anybody's willy on telly. But in the theatre where you're doing it, of course, the blinders go off and you're left on stage with 2,000 people looking at 10 blokes with their willies out, right?
One of whom is Ashley Banjo. Good luck to the rest of you.
Well, absolutely, right? And that was one of the things. Well, if I'm going to be standing here against Ashley Banjo, right, next to him, and with nothing on, I want to look as good as I can. So that's what happens, right? But then what happens, once you've done it, it's so exhilarating to be naked in front of those many people and be allowed to do it where it's not illegal, right? That's the thing, right?
Yeah. And there is that, Joe.
Yeah, there is that to it. And it was legally done. It was televised. I had a contract. I was allowed to do it. So at the end of it, Ashley Banjo and there's Alexander Armstrong at the end. Everybody's so elated. And I run over to and Ashley's done it for like two or three years beforehand, and so has Alexander, but they're still just as elated and so excited and buzzing. And I run over to Alexander, and we have a little hug, right? Bear in mind, we're naked, right? We're naked, but it don't matter, it's fine. And then Ashley joins in. He's naked. There's three of us. And then there's about another 15, 20 blokes all come on that all naked, right? And it's almost like you're doing the okie cokie with 15 naked blokes. But not separate. You're all closed up like in a huddle, like in a scrum in rugby. And all you can feel is all these willies on your leg going, oh no, get off me, get off me. And I had to run away from it. It was terrible. I hated it. I loved it up to that point. Yeah. Not good.
Good incentive, though. And also, like, brilliant examples, Joe, of, like, it is never too late, is it, to really push yourself to become somebody other than who you know yourself to be.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Well, I think we all know who ourselves to be, but I think we're all chameleons trying to fit in to what other people's boxes are. We're trying to go, well, that's what I think of it. And what I've learned as well over the years, and you can only learn this through getting older, is I used to go into a room and think, oh, what they'll think of me, and when I'm doing a show, what they think of me. And then as you get older, it's not that you don't care what they think of you. You realise that everybody in that room is thinking the same thing. They're all thinking, what does he think of me? And once you can apply that to your own self, you become less self-aware of it, and you become an observer of the situation rather than a participant in it, if that makes sense. And you can only do that as you get older through life experience, and you realise that you can only do the best you can and just be yourself. And it's hard to be yourself, though. But that's the best thing in stand-up, is it only really works when you're being yourself. That you have to be yourself, because otherwise an audience will see through
it. But then you go and become somebody else with another string to the bow that you've come to in recent years. You've become an author. You're writing horror fiction. And you love the genre, don't you? You love being scared.
Love it. Well, this comes back from when I got run over, because I couldn't go to bed, because I couldn't go up the stairs to bump my bed, because I was in these crutches in this heavy plaster. And my mum never trusted me not to go up there in case I fell down. There's nothing I could do, because I was accident prone anyway. And she had all these porcelain dolls with glass eyes. She had a big collection, about 40 of them, all around every room. Everyone was covered in these bloody things. And my mum and dad go to bed, and my brother and my sisters would go to bed early, and I'd be left up on the settee because I couldn't go to bed. And the telly was on. And every night, invariably, there'd be some horror film on. Normally the old Hammer films from the 60s or 70s. And
That was always your late night screening, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Nearly every night something could be on. And I became immune to being scared. And also these dolls, I'd look away and I think that one's eyes moved at me, and I became obsessed with these bloody dolls. And my mum even said to me that one of them's possessed. That's a good thing to tell your 13-year-old kid, isn't it? But she did. And then
sleep tight.
Yeah, it was that. It was. Oh God!
Was that a bedside manner?
It was. It was. It was like
doll.
It was like living in The Shining. That's what it was like, right? And then I started reading a lot of horror books as well. And Dracula was one of my favourite books as a kid. And in it, Bram Stoker wrote that Dracula came to Whitby on a ship called the Demeter. Then he drove to London on his Coulson car and blah, blah, blah. And he bought a house in London. Well, in actual fact, that's what they portray in the movies. But in the actual book, he said that he bought a house in a place called Purfleet, which is just adjacent to where I lived in Grays. And it's still there, but he bought a place in the book called the Carfax Estate. and it, which was an actual estate in the early part of the 20th century, and it was an insane asylum, and that's what Dracula bought. But it was based on a real place in Purfleet. And so when my leg got better, I went and tracked down this Carfax estate. And by then, in the 70s, it was now a council estate. But it was still, you know, it was in the book. So and I went around people's houses, knocking on the door, asking if they'd seen Dracula. And they all thought I was off my head, right? And ever since then, I've been in the search for vampires. I think vampires are out there somewhere. Anyway, that's beside the point. So I actually think that in our genealogy, in our genes, in the human race, in the human species, a couple of thousand years ago, we were being chased by animals, you know, like 150,000 years ago, it'd be saber-toothed tigers or whatever was coming after us. And so that fear is in us. But now in the 21st century, our lives are so much safer. The only things we have to fear are other humans, right? That's what you have to fear. Everything else is harmless to us now. So we have that gene in us that should be scared, that wants to be woken up and be scared because it's still in us, which is why there are roller coasters out there. Why do you want to get on a world's biggest roller coaster unless you want to be scared? Why do you want to watch the worst film?
Or
like
jump out of a plane.
Yeah, why do you want to do it? Because you've got that something in you wants to be scared. And that's what I love about writing horror, is I like to scare people. Because people think, oh, Joe Pasquale, he's written a book. I bet it's a kid's book. No, it's proper get your hands dirty, give you the willies at midnight with bad swearing in, it's bad stuff. It's really Stephen King time for me, and I love it.
When did you pitch to the publishers?
No.
The books, or did they come to you?
No, what happened was I was doing the degree with the Open University, and as a byproduct of doing some of the geology courses I was doing, I also did creative writing and advanced creative writing. And a friend of mine called Colin Edmonds, I'll give him a name check, who used to be Bob Monkhouse's writer and Des O'Connor's writer and blah, blah, all these. And as these big names were retiring and actually dying and going away to the other side, Colin's work diminished a little bit because he was writing for these big names. And when they stopped doing it, he was like, what do I do? And he started writing steampunk novels. And he's a hugely successful steampunk novelist now. And so what I would do, I would write my stories, my creative writing. And before I would send them to my tutor, I would send them to Colin and say, Colin, can you have a look over this story for me and just help me with my grammar? Because I was terrible at grammar at that point. So I said, just, you know, tell me where I should put this, you know, where to put this comma, what do I do here? Is that too long? Do I start the sentence with a but or not? And all these sort of things. And he would correct them for me. I'd send them in. I'd get a better mark because of Colin's help on it. And then unbeknownst to me, all these stories that I was sending to Colin, he sent to his publisher and said, look, you should look at these stories. And out of the blue, one day I get a phone call from this publisher saying, Mr. Jeff Pasquale, I said, Colin Edmonds has been sending me some of your stories. How many have you got? I said, well, I've only got about 10. He said, if you can do 13, I'll publish them. I said, well, as good as this. And that was it. It was just a thing that rolled away from me.
Wow.
Yeah.
How lovely is that, Joe? What a nice thing for him to do. Because he's, in the circles of television writers, he's a bit of a don, isn't he? He's one of the big guys, one of the good guys.
Colin, he is. And I first worked with him when I was doing a Des O'Connor show 30-odd years ago, and Colin used to be in Des's room writing for him all those days. And I'd go in and tell him what my material was going to be, and they'd rewrite it for me, where it was suitable for Des and all that sort of stuff. And it's just a genius to be able to write like that, you know, for other comics. And you could just give him a subject, and he'd, like that, I'll give you 6 jokes for that. And between him and Bob Monkhouse, that was amazing with Bob as well.
Wow. What a 40 years you've had, Joe, in this business.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Good luck with the next 40 or however many you manage to squeeze out of it.
Thank you.
Been really lovely talking to you today, Joe, and good luck with the tour. You're on the road now until October?
Yes, I am. Yes, please come.
Get those tour legs up and running. And if anybody does want to explore your horror fiction, what are the books called and where can they find them?
The first two is called Dead Knobs and Doomsticks 1, and the second one is called Dead Knobs and Doomsticks 2, Tales of the Lockdown, because I wrote that one during lockdown. And then the latest one is called Of Mice and Wolfmen. And they're short horror stories. They're only about 10, 15 minutes long at each story. So if you're a bit constipated and you can't go, take the book with you. In one sitting, I'll guarantee you'll go.
like literary prunes.
That's exactly what it is. Yes. Yes, it is.
You can have that for the next sleeve.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Thank you.
Joe, thank you so much. I really have enjoyed your company.
So I've enjoyed yours immensely. Thanks, Kate. It's lovely to see you again.
If you've enjoyed listening in on Joe, why not head over to the back catalogue where you'll find more Jungle Conversations with kings and queens of ITV's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. We've got the legend, Mylene Klass, Scarlett Moffat, Georgia Toffolo, Phil Tufnell, Sean Ryder, Nick Knowles and Charlene White, to name but a few. I'll be back on Tuesday with another chance for you to rediscover some vintage guests in our Something from the Cellar mini-eps. And next Friday, I'll be back with you and a brand new guest. Until then, thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.